So welcome to another conversation as part of the Social Impact Summit. And right now I am joined by Jem Kennedy, the founder, director of Queers & Co. And Jem does a range of things that kind of make her the facilitator of those that are creating social change by the work that she does with them. So Jem, if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the work that you do.
Sure. So I'm a transformational coach. First of all, I qualified with Animas in 2018. And after that, I've kind of developed into having a one-to-one practice, working with clients, often queer clients and allies to queer people. And then in my one-to-one practice, obviously, I tend to work with people who are making social change in some way. And I'm also a podcaster. I have created some zines around the thing that I coach around. What else? Yes, there's the community, Queers & Co. And then I guess last of all, but probably not least important, is that I'm also an activist myself. Yeah, that's the end.
So there's lots going on there. And you sort of talk about this idea that you are coaching or supporting those that are in the world of social change and social impact. And I'm just curious about how you got into that piece of the work.
I think it was probably my own experience of shifting from being someone who was quite inactive in society. Like as a teenager, I was very interested in social change, but then I kind of lost my path somewhere along the way, but came back to it after having children. And when we started home educating and kind of learning about self-direction and lots of other I guess alternative ways of being in the world, then I discovered this thing called body positivity after having a long history with eating disorders. And it was having some coaching with someone who also qualified with Animas, Laura McAvoy, who's brilliant. After having coaching with her, I brought this kind of issue around having body issues to her. And I just found it so enlightening to find that other people experienced the same thing. And I kind of knew cognitively that obviously there were other people, but I didn't really know at the same time. And so learning more about body positivity kind of set me off on this trajectory where I was like, oh, well, if this has made such a difference in my life, I want to help other people to make differences in their lives. And I'll go and train to be a coach so that I can facilitate that in some way. So from the beginning, my focus on my coaching practice was that I would work with people around body issues. And actually very quickly what materialized was that there was so much more than that. It was a useful entry point for me, but after I kind of worked through that, there was so much other stuff to be done and so many other movements to work with, I guess, to learn more about and to be an ally to if I'm not a member of those, you know, marginalized groups myself. That, yeah, it kind of, looking back, it seems like a really straightforward experience or journey, but it really wasn't at the time. Yeah, I just kind of bounced around between a few different things and then, yeah, ended up here.
I think that's something that quite a few people have spoken about, this idea that there isn't always this set path that you're going to walk towards. There are things that happen until there's something that sort of catches your eye or catches your focus. And then it's like, right, that's the thing that I'm going to hone in on. And that's the thing that I'm going to move with and work towards. Mm-hmm. So I know that some of your work is around a body image, but I'd also like to kind of hear about the work of Queers & Co. Because I remember when we were sort of talking beforehand, this conversation around the title of your company or the name of your company and sort of how that came about, as it were.
Yeah, and it's interesting because my work has very much shifted away from body stuff. It's definitely part of what I want to do, but I started that work thinking I'm going to go and speak to the most body confident queer people that I can find, because I read The Prosperous Coach and I was like, I need a project. And this this was my project. And queer people are really underrepresented in body positive spaces. It's slightly improving, but still not great. And as I started to have these interviews with people, I think during the first one, I just thought, I cannot keep these to myself. They're really helpful to inform my work as a coach, but I need to do something with them. And so I started making zines and sort of compiling. Lots of people were in the queer community, often performers or activists, and we started talking about body stuff, but then it just like went much bigger than that. And how do they navigate burnout? How do they sustain their activism? They were the things that I found really fascinating. And so it kind of gained momentum into having the zines, and then creating a Facebook community just where people could gather and talk about that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until I came to trademark, because I'm not actually a limited company as Queers & Co, it's just a trademark and a community organisation. And when I came to trademark the name, it was actually declined by the IPO because they said that queer was deemed an offensive term in, I think it was offensive to British culture and values, something like that. And obviously I was like, hell no, that's not okay. As a queer person, you can't say my identity is offensive. And then I started a petition with change.org, and it kind of spiraled. 16,000 people supported it, and I ended up meeting some really great people that helped me with the campaign. And eventually it was overturned, and we were allowed to use that name. But it was really interesting seeing it wasn't just about the fact that Queers & Co wasn't able to identify, you know, choose how they self-identify. It was bigger than that, in that there are lots of names and words that have been reclaimed by marginalized communities, and they were not, if you're not allowed to use them, like, who says you can use them or you can't? If you don't belong to that community, who are you to say that, you know, that isn't an acceptable or an appropriate word? So it kind of opened up a whole can of worms of like, wow, this isn't just, it's not just my problem. Like, loads of people are experiencing this.
Yeah, I really love the idea that through the naming of your organization, you were already creating social impact and social change by getting things overturned and bringing people together to work with you to create that overturn. But also I would imagine that by bringing those people together, that then created connections for other projects that you went on to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole aim of creating a community, not just a zine, was to actually bring people from different movements into one space. And we've had physical meetups, obviously that's really challenging now, but now we're online. But having those spaces where someone can say, you know, they're a trans activist, or they're working on anti-racism, and is there someone else who has this experience that can help them? That was something I really wanted to create a space for, because I think so often movements are very, they're very separate from each other, and really we all want the same thing. We may want it for, you know, maybe slightly different reasons or different groups of people, but essentially all marginalized groups want to be able to exist in the world as they are without, you know, being oppressed. And by working together and talking about what has worked, what hasn't worked, I think it's just a really, a much more helpful and powerful way to tackle something, instead of starting from scratch every time. And because often the history of marginalized communities isn't documented very well, every movement is having to relearn what previous movements knew but were unable to pass on, or did their best to pass on, but, you know, for whatever reason, the material wasn't respected, it wasn't kept by people who didn't think it was of any use. And so there's this constant relearning that has to go on. And I think it's being able to bypass that or queer that in a way feels really exciting to me.
So there's something really wonderful about this idea that it's not just the work that you're doing or the areas that you're interested in, but you're sort of bringing people together from so many different communities and creating a space that enables that social impact and that social change to take place or to be supported. It's almost like you're the supporter of the social change makers.
Yeah, that's my aim. I mean, right now, Queers & Co isn't huge, but my aim is and has always been to grow it to be a space where people, you know, generally have shared values, but there's clearly going to be a lot of learning that still needs to go on to understand other people's movements or other people's oppressions, and to almost like act as some kind of an incubator or a hub where people can come, you know, I'm working on this campaign, who can help you with this, who has these tools, or who's been through a similar situation, and there are just people there who are able to help and facilitate that. And I think that part of being an activist, it can be incredibly lonely, and you're sort of standing up and having difficult conversations with people, and not having a community around you is another route to really easy burnout. And so, you know, having that community, even if you're not working collaboratively with that community on something, just knowing there are other people who have your back and who also are navigating burnout and trying to keep going in this world, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, it's one of the conversations that we've been having about, you know, when you work to create social impact, create social change, it can feel like a very lonely space to be in. And without a community or a support network around you, it's very easy to burn out or to give up, to find it just too insurmountable to create that change or to continue with those projects. So there's something really great about this community and space that you've created that allow people to connect even if they're not working on the same things. A thought that comes to me around this is that, you know, I've known from running community groups myself or Facebook groups, that sometimes it can be a challenge to manage or moderate these groups. So I'm just wondering, is there anything that you've sort of learned through those challenges that you could share?
It's interesting because actually the group itself has been incredibly low conflict. People are generally really supportive and really want to help wherever they can. I guess in terms of my wider work, how I would, it's a really good question. It's something I'm still navigating, I guess, because quite often in social media culture, there's this real culture of like cancelling people. As soon as we disagree with something someone says, we just cancel them. And actually, from speaking to various people and kind of like Nova Reid, I don't know if you know her work, it's amazing. She's an anti-racist advocate, and she talks about actually those are the people that you need to have the difficult conversations with, and rather than like cancelling someone or kicking them out of the group or, you know, shaming them by saying I can't believe you think this or whatever, actually talking to them as maybe saying something like, oh, I used to think like this, or oh, I have experience of feeling that way, but how about if you think about it like this? And for me, that was like a huge light bulb to realize that even if people are expressing really problematic opinions, it doesn't mean you need to kick them out or, you know, not have them involved in a space necessarily. Obviously, when it feels dangerous for other people, that's a different conversation. But if there is a way that you can have those difficult conversations with people by really relating to them on a human level, then I think that's really powerful. And it's certainly more effective than just cancelling someone and, yeah, moving on, because I think people then become more and more ingrained in their opinions and their misinformation.
Yeah, I really hear that. And I think that's part of that, the sort of the coach's skill set to go, let's have a conversation about this and explore this to see, you know, what can we understand from this and where might we find a place of meeting as opposed to just explore our place of disagreement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a fine line between the whole like, oh, we'll agree to disagree. But actually, when you are a marginalized group and someone who isn't in that marginalized group is arguing against your existence, for example, there's, I'm just thinking of the trans community at the moment, and all the issues that they're facing around having to debate their existence, essentially. And that isn't a debate that is appropriate to be having when you're kind of debating whether someone has the right to exist in the world. So I think also being really clear about like, yes, we can have this conversation, but when it comes to a marginalized person fighting for their right to exist, then like that's unequal and there's something that needs to shift there so that that person isn't taking that all on themselves. Because that, you know, that's exhausting, and that's why people burn out very often, because they're working for social change relentlessly, and if you have a lot of people around you who don't believe or don't listen to you, don't respect your lived experience, then that can be really challenging.
And so there you are sort of supporting people to go through these experiences to manage the projects or the social change that they're trying to create. And I wonder, for you, how do you manage your own energies and keep yourself from that burnout?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think it's interesting because I've been thinking about this a lot because I mentioned to you before we talked that I've sort of created a course to help other people do this. And a lot of the ways are things that I've kind of gathered along the way that I've found that have helped me. Things like the values exercise I always use from that we did with Animas on the training, where people identify their values and then actually thinking about when are you living in and out of alignment with these values, whatever they might be. Radical self-care, so not bath bombs, like actually having boundaries, saying no to things, realizing that when a conversation is going on, if you don't have the energy to get involved and to talk about something that you're consistently exhausted by, actually allowing yourself to be like, okay, not today, someone else can take that over for me, or someone can do that. I mean, I'm saying this, I have an awful lot of privilege, so I'm not saying this as though I spend my life exhausted and fighting for my existence, but these are the kinds of things that I would support other people to do. Radical self-care is really important for me, and I think also I've noticed maybe a more, I don't know if this is quite the right word, but like I'm going to say it, spiritual, but I think actually what I mean is intuitive, maybe a more intuitive element of my practice and my life. So I actually allow myself to sit with whatever is going on and think about, okay, what feels good to me, what feels like the next step, rather than thinking about that kind of cookie cutter, like, oh, well, you want to build a business and these are the steps you need to take and then you're going to end up being like a millionaire. Actually thinking about, okay, what feels good to me? Does it feel good to me to do this thing? If it doesn't, then I'm not going to do it. And I, will find another way to do it. So there's kind of a whole load of things tied up in how I look after myself, but also community is super important. I didn't realize how important it was until I started really doing this kind of work and having people around you that even you, I guess after, maybe it was a bit before I trained as a coach as well, being introduced to active listening and just having space to speak out about what your issue is, or without someone feeling the need to give you advice or jump in and fix you in any way, and having that sense of community and those spaces is also really important, I think.
So we've sort of touched on the fact that you work doing lots of different things, and if somebody was listening to this and they're sort of thinking, I want to work supporting other people doing that, what would be sort of some of the steps that you think would be useful for them to consider in either creating a company or creating a group or creating that sort of vision or mission?
I think, first of all, thinking who it's for. And it's very easy to say you want to help X kind of people or, X group, but actually, are you creating the space that those people need, that they will feel safe in, that they will feel able to show up as themselves in? I think that feels really like a first step, because even if you have ideas of how you want a space to be, is that what the group needs? And then I guess maybe talking to people, asking them what they need and, what's missing? What do you need to support you in this work? Or how would, what's missing that you wish you had, and then maybe that's something that you could provide. I think when I set out, it was talking to lots of different people and noticing the same themes emerging over and over again, burnout being an issue, for example. So if you do that kind of set out on a project, as Rich Litvin says, see what you find, who you find, and then you can kind of draw the themes from there and start to build a base. And each time, if you're wanting to work collaboratively, each time you're kind of making a new step, like check in with people. Does this feel good? Doesn't it feel good? I'm all about like things being consent-based. So it's not of interest to me to run something that I think should be a certain way and no one actually wants it, but I keep going anyway. I did try lots of different things, just experiment, try things out. If they don't work, it's okay. It doesn't mean that you're a failure or that no one wants your work. It's just that particular way of delivering it isn't working for that group, so how could you do it slightly differently? I think thinking of things as an experiment and sort of collecting the data on what helps and what doesn't help, and then, you know, reformulating and then trying again has been useful for me anyway.
And also, you know, when you talk about, you know, having those conversations with the group to see if it's right for them, there's a question that just kind of came up for me around, do we need to be part of that group in order to work with that group? And if we're not part of that group, how do we sort of navigate that territory?
I think that's a really important thing to consider. I think, for example, for me, it wouldn't have felt appropriate to have Queers & Co. if I wasn't a queer person, because how do you show up in that space and have a true understanding of what it's like to exist as a queer person? I think there are places or ways that you can be an ally to certain groups, but I think that doesn't involve centering yourself. And so I think probably you shouldn't set up a group for that group of people. Maybe you should be looking for the people who could facilitate that, the people who would be great at working with that group of people because they belong to them. And then how can you help? Like, what tools do you have that you could help those people to set up whatever it might be? You can work behind the scenes. I do think there's something about decentering your own role, your own the role that you play in that space if you do not belong to that group of people.
I think there's something really interesting there that, you know, you might not belong to that group, but you can still work with that group and you can be an ally to that group. But also you may not deliver the project, but you can create the project and bring people in to support mm-hmm. the delivery of that or the understanding of that, so that you can sort of have an input in creating that change without necessarily being on the ground physically doing it. I think it's really interesting for people to consider around that, but also to consider, you know, why are they wanting to be part of creating a change around that? What's driving them or pulling them towards supporting that group or creating that difference? I think those are some really interesting things to consider.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's something about also when you say about considering why people want to support that group, it's really great to want to support other people to make social change. And it's also, if you find that you're kind of wanting to do it out of a sense of like, wow, everyone's going to think I'm brilliant and amazing, then that's probably not why you should be doing it. If you can be behind the scenes and be like a phone call away from someone who is working on something and you are able to support them from a distance and fully believe in them, maybe give them coaching if that's the area that you work within. But yeah, I definitely think there's something to be said for like stepping back. This isn't my space. This is a space that I really want to ally with and support, but I'm not going to take the lead because it doesn't belong to me. Like, this isn't my story. This isn't my lived experience. And there will always be times, if you are making decisions for other groups, there will always be times where the decisions you're making are like not based in any actual reality because you haven't experienced it. So how can you do that? So I think it's very much being conscious of what your role is and where you can and should take a backseat, do it.
Yeah, I think there's something really powerful about that lived experience, but also that idea, if you don't have that lived experience, you can still be part of something, mm-hmm. but you need to consider what that lived experience is and how that sort of fits into the projects that you're creating.
Yeah.
And as you were saying that, it made me sort of think about, where does coaching sort of fit into some of the work or the projects that you are part of?
I think... So in different ways, in my one-to-one practice, it fits in with supporting activists who are, you know, in different movements, making different social changes, but essentially giving them a space where they don't have to explain their queerness in order to have like a base level starting point. They turn up, they show up exactly as they are. They don't have to explain like, oh, this happens, and then, you know, I feel like this about a certain thing. There's like a shared, I can't really, it's almost like going down to a friend's house and they know your experience. You can just jump right in. You don't have to explain how you've got to that point. So I think that sort of commonality is really helpful. And then also for me, my one-to-one practice, I love it, but there isn't possibly enough time to work with everyone that I want to work with. So that's why I created a course, so that I can actually share the tools with people who are working towards making social change. We have group coaching every week, so it's an hour and a half group coaching session throughout the 9-week course. And then so far the cohort that I have run already is like the best community. It was like introducing all my best friends. You know, when you go to a wedding and you're like, here's all my brilliant friends, you can all finally meet each other. It was like introducing my clients, friends that I have from the home ed community, and just putting them all together. And they've all stayed in touch. They all want to carry on with monthly calls because they just love that space and being able to connect with like-minded people. So I also offer coaching kind of through that. And I feel like a combination of one-to-one and group coaching has been really helpful in the work that I do. Things like setting boundaries, working to make spaces as safe as possible for different groups of people who have, you know, clearly have trauma around being in spaces previously that are not safe for them. All of those things I think have come from me training as a coach, and I wouldn't know about them had I not experienced the, because I did the Animas transformational coaching course, and then I went on to do the group coaching weekend. And so both the combination of those, I think, has been really helpful.
And do you bring in other coaches to work with you on your projects?
So far I haven't. It's something I definitely would be interested in doing at some point. And I guess I was talking actually to another Animas coach the other day who is looking to do a similar kind of thing. And it was so nice to have a conversation with someone who wants to work around like neurodiversity and just doing things differently, essentially. I think the thing that I've found is that coaches definitely do exist, but everyone's doing their own stuff. And I would really like to collaborate with people, but right now I'm still kind of building the parts that I play in those things, I guess.
So, you know, it's really interesting because I'm hearing this and it feels like you've got a whole team of people working with you, and to hear that it's you kind of managing all of this on your own, it sort of makes me wonder about, so how do you plan this that enables you to project manage the various things that you do?
Yeah, I think so I should also mention my hours are quite restricted because I have two young children who are home educated. So I don't have loads of time, but I don't have full-time working hours, and I don't offer coaching hours, one-to-one sessions on a full-time basis. So I have 2 days, I'd say, where I'm offering coaching one-to-one sessions. And then planning-wise, I tend to just, because I love it, because it's my life, I don't really see it as, I know this can be really problematic when you have no work-life balance, but actually my community is also my work. So just socializing, just like hanging out in the places where the people I want to be with and I want to coach are, is like a joy. I absolutely love it. So I feel like it's just every part of my life is involved in this. And the coaching course is every Thursday evening when it runs for the 9 weeks. So again, that's once my children are in bed, so I can do that. I think it's almost like I wish there were more hours in the day so I could do more, but I think I love it so much that I have the energy to keep doing it and know that I can tell when I'm sort of edging close to burnout, and then I'll pull back and, you know, reevaluate. But yeah, I just really love doing it, so it doesn't feel too arduous.
There's something really interesting there about, we often talk about work-life balance, and I was listening to a podcast recently where they were talking about work-life integration and this idea of how do you bring these things closer together so they overlap, as opposed to this separation of these things. And it sounds very much like that's what you're doing. You're able to integrate those two pieces together, so it doesn't feel like you're sort of interrupting your life space or your social space with your work. It's actually these things interconnect and are a part of each other.
Yeah, I think that I've never heard that as a thing before, so that's really interesting. I'll go in and check it out. And I think for me, I guess the only way I can describe it is like being in flow. When I am having conversations with people during the day in between clients or in between working on something, and I'm really I just feel really spurred on and like really inspired by whatever it is they're working on. And yeah, it's just, for me, it's an entirely different way of living. And I never would have imagined that I could find a job that didn't feel like a job at all. And I know that sounds really cliche, but to actually have the energy to like really want to pour yourself in and to be able to show up as I am. There are lots of jobs I've done where I haven't been able to show up authentically for whatever reason. And so actually, like, you get so much energy from just being yourself and working with people who are themselves. That's so great. Like, if you're just starting from that and can have conversations around boundaries and, you know, all the other things that come with that, it's so energizing. And I think it just allows you to keep going rather than thinking, oh, I really need like 2 weeks off to do nothing and talk to no one. I miss my friends and the people that I enjoy bouncing ideas off of, if that was the case.
I think there's something else there as well, that your time is restricted. So you've got two young children, and so that sort of restricts when you work and how you work. And I think sometimes when we have less time, we become more focused in what we're doing because we don't have that time to be unfocused or to waste. And there's something really interesting about, you know, I've got 3 hours to do this piece of work, and that's all I have because the kids will be awake, or it will be at 2 o'clock in the morning, or whatever that might be. And it's like, this is my work time and this is my focus time.
Yeah, that's so true. And I've noticed, because this week the children's dad has been off work, and so he's been having them a bit more, and so I've had a lot of time, and I thought, wow, I'm going to be so productive. And actually my mind has been wandering, like, I've got two whole days and I could just, you know, go and do something else. So actually having those limits of, you know, I've got a client at 11:30 and then I've got an hour's break. Okay, I'm going to really quickly do that thing that I've been needing to do, and then onto another client. And it feels, yeah. And I guess it's important to say, it doesn't feel productive in like a capitalist sense. Like, I have to squeeze every money earning opportunity out of every minute of the day. It actually just feels like, if I'm in flow and enjoying what I'm doing, then it doesn't, you know, I'm just being productive and I like doing that.
So you spoke about money there. One of the conversations I've had with a few people around social impact projects is whether they're funded, whether they're self-funded, whether they're funds generating. I just wondered, so how does that sort of sit with you?
So I don't have any funding. I was thinking about getting some funding for the zine when I first started doing it, and I had a few sponsors who said they'd be interested, but then I just thought, actually, I'd really like to be able to create what I want to create instead of, you know, being limited in a way. And everything else, like the events that we have done and with Queers & Co, have all just been people buying a ticket or a spot in whatever the event is. And so, yeah, it hasn't really been something that I've had to do. I guess my considerations around funding have been more that there are people who I want to be able to access my work who could not afford my work if I charged full price. And so I've been experimenting with like a few different models, and that has been super interesting to start at the place that I felt was the most fair or was like going to be most beneficial to people, and actually realizing that totally didn't work. That was a sliding scale option of coaching fees, and to where I am now, where it's a completely different model. I don't know if that would feel helpful to talk about, but
because I think sometimes when people think about creating these sorts of projects, there can be this sticking point, because a lot of social impact projects are on a volunteered basis. Mm-hmm. So people are giving up their time, and so they then have to work out, well, how do I earn and volunteer? And then some people I've been speaking to have spoken about how this is their work. So it's not about volunteering or working, it's their work. So they're looking for paid opportunities to do this. And so I'm imagining that people that are listening to this, some of them are going, oh, okay, so you're making a living out of this social impact work. Mm-hmm. So how are you sort of enabling that to take place?
Yeah, so I think in the beginning, I totally wasn't. I just wanted to be able to allow people to access my work who could. And then I had another job that I earned money from in order to sustain things. But actually, since I switched to not having a sliding scale that people can choose to opt into, so I would have three different prices and then people could choose based on their circumstances which was the most comfortable. And unfortunately, my experience and lots of experience of people who do offer sliding scales is that not enough people opt into the higher scale. So it's very difficult to make it work. But because my work is social justice focused, I didn't want to have, you know, this is my fee and I only charge this. And if you can't afford it, you can't work with me. So how I do it now is that I offer, I have a coaching fee, like a per hour fee. And then for anyone who can't afford that, I have a payment plan option and a no interest payment plan. So you can use like software, I don't know if I'm allowed to name them, but like things that will take the payment on the same day every month. And people are able to spread it out over as long a period as feels good to them. Which means then that I know every month how much money I'm getting from my clients on payment plans because it's already scheduled. Which helps me with cash flow. And also it means that they are able to still access something, but pay it off over a longer time with absolutely no penalty for not having the funds available. There are so many things like if you sign up now, you get it at this price, but actually that can be really difficult for people who essentially poorer people always end up getting charged more, which is not fair. So having payment plans and then running my course, I have bursaries. So the price is a certain amount. Again, payment plans are available and there's no application process or like people literally have a discount code on my site. They put it into the basket and they pay the first payment plan installment. And then after that, I will invoice them for the other ones. Or I have for trans folks and for people of colour as needed, bursaries that are available and anyone can just drop me an email and say, hey, I need a bursary, fine, like you're very welcome to have one. Because I think that in the queer community there's very often these kind of different payment structures and essentially trying to make my work accessible to anyone who wants to access it but also recognizing I need to make a living from it is a difficult balance, but it's one that I feel like really works now that I've tried a few different ways.
Yeah, and that's really important to hear, that this idea that you can make it work and you can charge money for this work, make a living from it, but still have an impact and still create change and still support people without thinking that you have to, for want of a better word, suffer to help others. Because I think that right. can be a boundary around this work or a block around this work, that idea of, well, do I put myself out in order to help others, and so how might one do this? And hearing that you're able to make a living, that you've found all these different ways to make your work accessible to whoever needs it, without reducing the price so much that you're not able to support yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also it's important to mention that, you know, over lockdown, for example, I was offering by donation coaching just because I wanted there to be a space that if people needed and really couldn't afford it, then that existed. But those things are completely optional. And if you want to coach someone pro bono, you're very welcome to, like, no one says you can't. But also there is something for me in like the exchange of energy in some way. And if someone really can't afford to pay, then, you know, perhaps they have like amazing marketing skills or they, you know, are a copywriter, whatever it might be. And then you could switch. But finding ways to make it work without devaluing your kind of work or your sense of a need to actually be able to survive and pay your bills, because you are no use to anyone if you give all your stuff away for free and then, you know, burn out because you're working 10 other jobs at the same time. So it's actually about how you make the work you want to do sustainable for yourself and for your clients, because you're going to be able to keep going for a lot longer and help a lot more people.
And I love the idea that you've tried different things to find the space that's for you. Earlier on, you talked about, you know, experimenting. It's like, it's great to hear that you experimented until you found the space that was right for you, that enabled you to work in a way that supports you and supports others. So there's a sustainability around the work. So I think this is something else that's a challenge with some of the social impact projects, is we're unable to sustain them either because of the energy that they take or the lack of funds that they create. So they have this kind of finite time that isn't a designed finite time. It's kind of an imposed finiteness.
Yeah, and it's a problem across social justice in general, I think, that lack of lack of ability to be sustainable for all kinds of reasons. But it's so important, because otherwise, without that, yeah, it's like a train running out of steam, like half a mile down the track. Okay, well, then you're no use to anyone. So I think part of this work is building in ways that you can be sustainable. And if that means, like, I've in the beginning, I was adamant that I didn't want to work with people that were not my ideal clients. And actually, for me, I'm also an EFT and literature and printing practitioner. And so I also offer, if people come to me and they have like a thing that is not around social change, but they want some support with anxiety, for example, then I will 100% like enjoy and want to do that and get paid for doing that. It's not exactly the kind of work that I want to be doing all the time, but it's something that I'm very happy to do. And I'm also, I think often we can be quite hung up on how we earn our money, and that this kind of sense of like morality, like if we don't earn it from the way that we want to the most, then we're failing or we're not good enough or something. And for me, actually, realizing that I have a lot more resources open to me than I realized, and it's great if I can earn my money in the way that feels best to me, but I'm not going to beat myself up if I am doing something that's slightly different, if I do something that isn't coaching at all. I think there can be a lot of pressure on people to do that.
And when you think about the projects that you do and have run, can you sort of name something that you're, for want of a better word, most proud of, or something that you've kind of gone, yeah, I've done that and that was amazing, or I've worked with that person and they've created this program or this change, and that's sort of brought you a sense of joy?
Yeah, I think I was thinking about that, and actually it feels really hard because there's quite a few where I just feel really happy. I guess one of them that springs to mind was actually one of my practice clients. So when I first started training with Animas, who went on to set up a disability rights charity and supporting other disabled people to bring action, like legal cases against companies and different organisations that were not adhering to the Equality Act 2010, for example. So places where like shops did not have a ramp for absolutely no reason, and then wheelchair users were not able to access their shop. And that it's been amazing to watch that grow and to see like all of the things that have come for that person they were already smashing it and amazing before we started working together, but it's been so great to see like the things we talked about actually now exist. And even saying that, I have goosebumps. I just think it's so cool. And lots of other things, even something I'm really like, I hope to be really clear about, is it's not about setting up like a massive charity that does lots of, you know, formalized things. It's also about working with people who make changes in their own lives that ripple out in their community. So I have clients who, for example, have gone through a process of like becoming more empowered and being able to then speak out about what it is they need. That might be in the workplace, that might be in their family situation or wherever, and are able to make changes, and because of that end up being able to go on to do like all these awesome projects that they may not ever have taken on. For example, I had a client, and I obviously want to be mindful of confidentiality, but they did things like start sharing their LGBT society in their workplace, and then did a project through another qualification they were studying for that was really aligned with their queerness that they never would have considered bringing into that space. So it's sort of creating space to have conversations that you wouldn't normally consider appropriate or socially acceptable in other spaces. And I think that's, you know, that's activism in itself, just living your life in a way that feels good to you and allows you to be your best self. That sounds really cheesy, but you know what I mean.
and you spoke about queerness there, and your company's Queers and Co. And I toying with the kind of exploring what does that term mean for you.
I think for me it was about centering queer people, because that's what my work, my one-to-one work, started out doing. So it's Queers and Co, and the Co is like allies, you know, anyone who also is like, hey, I'm open to like having these conversations as well. And I think so often you know, even in the LGBTQ plus in that acronym, I think it's an acronym, my mind just went blank, even in there, like, there are so many different people and different beliefs and like different cultures and everything in that acronym. Whereas queer is a very, for me, it's like such an expansive label. And I think it's a real, it was the first label that I found that really encapsulated all of my identities or like who I consider myself to be. And so it was a word that felt really special to me. And centering queer people in my work and then having the ANCO to make sure that it wasn't just for queer people, like it's also for people who want to show up and align themselves with those conversations or causes as well. That, yeah, I guess that's how I describe it.
Lovely, lovely. And what's next for Jen? Where do you go next? What's your, with all the million things that you're doing, what's your next project or your next plan?
Yeah, so I want to have the second series of my podcast, that's one of the plans. I want to write a book, and I think that will, I can feel like the work that I'm doing is building towards that, but at some point I'd like to do that. And I think really, so the course that I'm running is running again in October, and I want to essentially get that to a place where people are just referring, you know, oh, you need some help with like this project you're working on, you should go and do this course. So really focusing on that for the next year or so. Essentially, I think to work out how I can scale it, so maybe it can be delivered in a way that does involve me, but doesn't involve me having to like do it over and over again, maybe larger groups, but I'm not sure how I would keep that feeling so safe and, you know, people being able to share. So that's probably something that I'm wanting to work around. And then I have this idea around lots of companies have social responsibility or social impact budgets, and how do we access those in order to, I guess, in order to tap into the queer workforce and, you know, people who aren't able to show up in their workplaces as themselves. How do we, like, my ideal project would be to go through some kind of exploration of like, how do queer people get more support in the workplace and in their daily lives so that they feel empowered to show up as they are and have those difficult conversations, and people around them feel more educated on queer issues as well, I guess. But then there's also part of me that's like, but I want that for all the different movements that like people I know work within as well. So essentially I want to build it to something bigger, but I'm not entirely sure what that looks like yet. It's kind of still developing. Yeah.
that sounds amazing. I can just kind of see this sort of this force moving through organizations that kind of tap into the different, I guess, communities or societies or cultures that exist within those organizations, mm-hmm. and enabling them to have a voice and to speak out and feel supported. And then just kind of noticing all of the ripple effects that that then has as it comes into society as well.
Yeah, and people having conversations with like family members, with their children. I'm really, I'm a real believer in like activism starts at home, and so you're doing the work in your house and with the people you know and care about, like you're not really being that effective anyway. So yeah, I think that's a really good starting point.
Well, Jem, it's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you. I feel like I've learned a lot, or a lot has been kind of triggered in my thinking as we've been talking through this. So it's I've really enjoyed it. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you.